Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Happy to be living in the present instead of dwelling in the past.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, the new host of Jeopardy, Mike Richards, is out after taping just a week's worth of shows following the revelation that he once did some podcasts. Yes, the executive producer of Jeopardy, who pulled a Dick Cheney by choosing himself as the new permanent host of Jeopardy during a search for a post-Alec Trebek host, has stepped down from the gig after The Ringer revealed that he, A, admitted to not being very good at trivia, B, said the word boobies in a discussion of nude selfies, said one-piece swimsuits are frumpy during a question about swimwear, used the words midget and retard. I know that's a tough one, but I'm just going to say it. Maybe we'll beep it out later. And most questionably, made a joke about Jewish people having big noses. I saw someone joke on Twitter that being the EP on a show hit with multiple lawsuits related to the treatment of women, as happened during Richards' tenure on Price is Right, was really no big deal, but hosting a podcast was bridged too far. And really, that does seem to be the issue here. The Ringer's expose didn't seem to uncover a ton, but it just kind of pushed everything over the edge. And it was like weirdly, almost kind of painfully, you know, PC. At one point, the author referred to a homeless person as a, quote, unhoused woman, end quote. And I, like, it's that sort of thing that just made me
say, inaccurate?
Is that inaccurate? What is going on here exactly? So here's how here is The Ringer's Claire McNear making the argument that is the center of the piece. Quote, in an online socially conscious world, Richards had a tall task ahead of him in proving not only that he deserves the Jeopardy job after a long and contentious process whose integrity many fans doubt, but also that he can embody the qualities, intellectual curiosity, cultural open-mindedness, and reverence for the topics, both silly and serious, that appear on the board that have made Jeopardy into a beloved touchstone, end quote. I don't know, guys. I thought the main quality of the show was knowing stuff and just, like, being good at trivia. And all of this really calls to mind the insane, the totally nutty kerfuffle a couple months back when a winner of the show held up three fingers during his third appearance on the program and people thought he was flashing a white power symbol. Alyssa, why are people losing their minds over this dumb game show? And how did Jeopardy end up becoming a culture war flashpoint?
I mean, everything is a culture war flashpoint, as you know, as well or better than any of us. But I think that there are a couple things going on here. One is that Jeopardy had this sort of bizarrely protracted audition process for the hosting job, which made no sense given that people knew that Alex Trebek was quite ill. He was older. They had a lot of time to think this through. There were a number of obvious candidates for the job. And then they seemingly chose someone who was attractive to no one.
Had no real constituency.
One of the new hosts. Yeah, exactly. So I think that, and, you know, they did it in a way that put the host sort of at the center of the show, which Trebek was always an appealing part of Jeopardy, right? I mean, he was sort of gentlemanly, erudite, but he was a perfect host in that he was an excellent foil for the competitors on the show. He allowed them to sort of showcase their personalities, what they were good at, et cetera. And so the search process kind of inverted the premise of the show and then produced a result that people were unhappy with before the fact that Richards was sort of obnoxious and unpleasant became broadly reported. The second issue here is, I'm sorry, I don't understand why either Hollywood corporate HR hasn't figured out how to vet people for jobs or why a private firm to just sort of vet people for their problematics has not been founded and become incredibly profitable.
Million-dollar idea right there, folks.
Like, clearly, I should quit my job as a Washington Post columnist and co-host of Across the Movie Aisle and start this because I would be a bazillionaire and could, like, fund random projects that the three of us would enjoy discussing on the show. So, peace, everybody. I'll see you later. But, yeah, it's maybe it's sort of silly that this is coming out in a, you know, very sort of very sensitively put piece on The Ringer. At the same time, why is The Ringer doing Sony's corporate HR work for it, right? I mean, this is obvious stuff, especially, I mean, like, especially in Hollywood, anything that's going to set off the ADL is like something you want to get ahead of. Like that part of the playbook people understand, or at least I thought they understood. But it's just the company comes out of it looking so stupid, and it has squandered so much goodwill for the show that I actually think that's much more the issue than the sort of specific complaints. But yeah, look, part of being a good host for a game show or a party at a private gathering is making everyone feel welcome and sort of comfortable and putting the guests first. And Richards was clearly not in a position temperamentally or otherwise to do that.
You know, I think there are two... There are a couple of different things going on here, Peter, but one thing that jumps out at me in particular is the idea that the Jeopardy host should already be a famous person strikes me as a weird one, and kind of counter to the show as it evolved. Yes, Alex Trebek became a cultural institution. I don't think anyone would deny that. Everyone, you know, if you saw Alex Trebek on the street, he's one of the few people in this world who everybody would light up with joy and say, "Ah, Alex Trebek, I love you." But the host, as Alyssa says, is not the point here. Like, why are people clamoring for famous faces to be the face of Jeopardy? Why is LeVar Burton the Twitter favorite? Why are people demanding that Aaron Rodgers give up his multimillion-dollar NFL paycheck to be, you know, a cue card reader
to
on
be
TV?
Fair, I mean, to be fair, LeVar Burton has successfully hosted an extremely popular nonpartisan television show for an incredibly long time, right? Like, I don't know if either of you grew up with Reading Rainbow.
Of course,
but
of course.
He is someone who is sort of eminently qualified for the job and wanted it, unlike some of the other people who were in contention.
But again, like, why is that? I am a little bit confused as to why that is the thing that people are, like, most focused on in the Jeopardy search, is finding somebody who we all recognize and are like, yes, we all need this person to take over here. I mean, it feels like it's a total misunderstanding of the show.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, James Holzhauser would have been who was a very successful contestant on the show, would have been fine, right? I mean, he would have been someone who understood the guest dynamic. It's, I mean, man, I don't know what everyone wants. The only intense Jeopardy watching period of my life has come during periods when I was hanging out with my late grandmother. So I am perhaps not the person to, you know, grok the Jeopardy fandom, which is apparently includes, you know, all of the same insane dynamics that make fandom in every other arena of public life terrible. But yeah, it's just Sony's full of idiots, apparently.
Peter, is Sony full of idiots?
I think I'm the wrong person to ask about why people care about this, since I do not in any way. And I don't even quite know how to relate to caring about this, because as you said, you know, everybody would light up if they saw Alex Trebek on the street. I would not. I mean, I guess I would now, because I'd be like, there's a dead guy on the street. And that would be very
Alex
strange.
Trebek.
No, like, he's not somebody who I have any strong feelings about one way or the other. It's not that I dislike Alex Trebek at all. He seemed perfectly fine and appealing in the one time that I have ever engaged with him directly, even as a viewer, which is watching Groundhog Day 1,000 times, and there's the scene in it, right? The repeat scene where Bill Murray ends up watching Jeopardy and he knows all the answers. And so from that, I know something about Alex Trebek, but that's it. And I don't get why people care about Jeopardy. I don't get why people care about the host. I love LeVar Burton. I like, I'm a Reading Rainbow a nerd and a Star Trek nerd. I do think Alyssa is right to point to the way that fandom has taken control of some of these things, and fandom has just exerted really weird pressure on a lot of cultural institutions, right? And Jeopardy is a kind of institution. The moderator of Jeopardy, Trebek himself, became part of that institution and in some ways his own institution outside of even Jeopardy the game. And so, you know, I suspect that people were looking for someone to fill in that sort of institutional figurehead role. And they felt like this rando who, yes, he's been involved with the show for a long time, but he has no public persona at all, right? Like, nobody knew who Mike Richards was 5 years ago or even 2 years ago. Sure, some people knew, but you know what I mean? He wasn't a household name in any sense. And LeVar Burton was even a few years ago, even 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And so they're looking for someone who can step in pre-made, right? And, you know, in some ways, I guess I sort of get it. In that you don't want somebody to come in and have their reputation built, like have the wrong reputation for the show. And people felt like Mike Richards had the wrong reputation for the show. But at the same time, I also think that the people who care this intensely about this sort of thing are probably a relatively small group of people who are merely very loud online. Jeopardy is popular. People do like it. It's run for forever. But you see this sort of thing with comic books. You see this sort of thing in the world of science fiction right now. You see this sort of thing in the YA industry. Just anywhere where there's sort of a public media presence, right? Like presence that people feel like they, you know, are super invested. There is a small group of intense super fans who feel like the institution isn't owned by the people who own it. Instead, it must be owned by the fans. And a lot of big corporations have ended up catering to that more than to anything else, which in some ways has let that sense of communal ownership sort of extend out and has validated it. Now, in some ways, it's okay, right? Like Spider-Man's mine. Like I get to, but at the same time, like
no,
I don't
isn't.
Get to decide what
he's Sony's,
and that's
he's not even Marvel's.
Well,
anymore,
sure,
really.
That's he's sort of Marvel gets Marvel has creative rights to live action Spider-Man.
They
get to make the movies. They signed, though. I think Sony does have to like sign off on some of this stuff.
No. These are all Sony movies that Marvel has. It doesn't matter. We're getting bogged down in details here.
Anyway, the point is that there is this weird sense of ownership.
Yeah.
In institutions that big companies have encouraged to some extent, and in some ways is a good marketing strategy because you want people to be invested in your pop culture property. And on the other hand, comes back to bite them sometimes when the decision makers at the corporation make a decision that the people who feel like they are stakeholders in that property, when they decide that they're going to be upset.
So here's what I would add to this is that it's not just a matter of fandom, and it's not just a matter of encouraging fandom and cultivating fandom. There's also a weirdly, explicitly partisan political tinge to a lot of this conversation. So I mentioned the weird controversy over the guy who the Facebook group of former winners thought had been flashing a white power sign. He literally was just holding up, I think he was holding up three, you know, and that was part of it. Also, people are now trying to cancel Mayim Bialik from her like guest hosting role because she posted some pro IDF stuff and is like kind of vax questioning adjacent something or other, you know. And it feels like this is a situation where there is an explicitly liberal or left-wing group of people who are trying to take down a group of people that they don't like for, like, again, almost explicitly political reasons.
I think especially with Bialik, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Some of the views that she espouses that have upset people, including suggesting that people who, you know, lose babies under certain circumstances were, like, doing something wrong, like blaming people whose kids die, don't map neatly onto a particular sort of political spectrum. And frankly, neither does anti-vax sentiment. And that is related to something that I think is going on with the rise of fandom as a sort of significant valence point for people's identities, which is that as culture replaces or becomes a proxy for politics, everything in the public square gets weirder. Because culture is weirder than politics. And so, you know, this is a place where kind of corporate mismanagement and self-interest are playing into a show that, you know, kind of has a conservative older, you know, or older And thus you might guess some more conservative fan base, but also a kind of younger activist wing of that as well. It's just, it's a weird set of multiple colliding buzzsaws.
I think the solution here is pretty obvious, and that's to have an AI host Jeopardy, right?
I've said this for weeks now.
The AI would know all the answers already because it's an AI and it knows everything. And in fact, if you wanted to, you could have Google maybe get together with Marvel, with one of the big effects houses. You could ask the estate of Alex Trebek to use his likeness. And you could just have like a General Tarkin style, right? Like you could
voicing Alex Trebek.
And then, and then you would have the image that everybody's comfortable with, along with no human personality that can be canceled behind it. And then you never have to hire another host again.
But would the AI be able to accomplish Trebek's greatest feat, which is heroically and half-nakedly chasing down a burglar during a time when he was off set? I mean, part of what people liked about Trebek is that he sort of became this character off the set of Jeopardy in a way that was sort of a little bit like wilder and more intriguing than the very sort of buttoned down, dapper person he was on set. I mean, the real solution here is just to let LeVar Burton host everything, including the Oscars.
AI LeVar Burton.
No hosts ever. Hosts should be banned. Get rid of all hosts.
Get rid of all public events.
So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Mike Richards got fired shortly after getting the job from Jeopardy? Alyssa?
It's a controversy.
Peter?
Sure, a controversy.
Yeah, it's a controversy. I still think the things he said on that podcast were relatively non-controversial, but it was the last straw in a cascading series of failures by Sony, as Alyssa mentioned. If you enjoy this show, and who doesn't, it's great. Nobody go back through our old episodes and find things that we said that were slightly offensive to get us all fired. Thank you. Make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we're going to be using the success of the new Paw Patrol movie to discuss taking kids to the movies. What are we taking our kids to see? What sort of memories did we form at the movies, Peter, Alyssa, and I? And that sort of thing. Should be a fun show. Speaking of memories, on to the main event, Reminiscence. Writer-director Lisa Joy, one half of the Westworld Brain Trust alongside husband Jonathan Nolan, presents a vision of the future where people have retreated into the past. Resource wars driven by global warming have left Miami and its people flooded and broken with nothing to live for. They use a machine that helps them relive memories to dive into the past. Reminiscence is sci-fi noir. Hugh Jackman stars as Nick Bannister, an interrogator turned dream guide who walks people through their pasts. He and his assistant Emily, played by Thandie Newton, help his wounded buddies from the war relive happier times. They help a woman rekindle an old flame. But it's a lost set of keys that need to be remembered that get him into trouble. That's what May, played by Rebecca Ferguson, is looking for when she walks into Nick's joint. But what Nick finds is a world of trouble. He falls in love with her. She disappears, and he can't stop reliving memories of their time together as he searches for any trace of the woman. Some say was just a junkie looking for a fix, and others suggest is more dangerous. We can talk more about the way the plot resolves later in our discussion. Spoilers ahead. I'll hold off on that for a moment. Here's what I liked about the movie. I liked the look of it. I liked the design. From the Venice-like cityscape of Miami to the design of Nick and Emily's bank vault/office to the smoky bars and nightclubs the world feels lived in. I liked all of the performances pretty much. Jackman and Ferguson and Newton, yes, but also Cliff Curtis as a corrupt cop and Daniel Wu as an Asian Creole and Angela Sarafian, who folks will remember from Westworld as a scorned lover. And there are great individual moments as when one of the characters kind of interacts with a memory upon realizing that one of the people in the memory is trying to send a message. But I'm not sure the thing works as a whole. It all feels slightly perfunctory in a way, like it was heavily edited to hit a 2-hour runtime. Nothing really gets a chance to breathe, and the ending feels like a little bit of a cop-out, honestly, as if Lisa Joy kind of edged up to the abyss, stared into it, and said, no, that's too dark. We're going to come back. We're going to pull it back just a little bit. Still, I am a sucker for Nolan-adjacent high-concept drama. Christopher's brother, Jonathan, is an EP on this, and as I said, partner of Lisa Joy and many various respects. And I like the look of it in IMAX. I went to go see this in IMAX, like almost out of spite, just to say I had done it. Peter, what say you about Reminiscence?
I did not love this movie. I thought it was interesting in the way that it pulled together a bunch of film noir references, as well as sci-fi references. There's a lot of Minority Report in this movie, a lot of Inception, a lot of Chinatown, a bunch of other films. It also sort of feels a lot like Westworld, you know, it just in the way that it's very slick looking in its use of, you know, its obsession with time and memory and identity and all those sort of Nolan Brothers concepts. But I just don't think it adds up to very much. There's a lot more sort of on the surface to this movie than there is depth. And so I want to take issue a little bit with your praise of the movie's visuals, which I think they're neat looking, and there's some interesting sort of surface level world building, but I think it's actually pretty shallow. There's just not a whole lot of sense of how people actually live and go about their days and how this world really works. It's except for the fact that there's a bunch of water everywhere and you have to ride a dinghy to get from your office to someplace else. It's not really a picture of a complete world, of one that has actually changed and been thought through. You know, there's just not actually that sort of texture of life that you see in the great world-building science fiction films. One that obviously comes to mind is Blade Runner, another sci-fi noir that takes place entirely basically at night. And what's great about Blade Runner, what makes that movie work, is that there are so many details that are in some sense irrelevant. They're not there just to be part of the plot. If you look anywhere in any of those frames, especially in the streetscapes, but even on the interiors, you will always find some little tiny detail that the set designer, that Ridley Scott, planted there that doesn't have anything to do with the scene. That is just telling you something about how this world works, that somebody has given it a huge amount of thought. And that's just not there in Reminiscence. And the other thing that I didn't like is that as pretty and as beautiful as that bank vault set is, I actually don't think it makes any sense. It's just too pretty. It's too gorgeous. And it's too interested in being kind of iconically beautiful, right? In a way that doesn't make sense for the world, right? Or the characters. So the Hugh Jackman detective character is supposed to be kind of on the ropes financially. He's not somebody who can afford, he's worried about his finances and that sort of thing. He only appears to have one employee. And yet in this world where poor people don't have a lot of dry space to themselves, he's got this just gigantic, beautiful, immaculate warehouse space. What would have been much more interesting is if he had been stuck in a dingy little basement, kind of wet, kind of dark, kind of dismal, with crappy equipment for most of the movie. And they, in fact, introduced the idea of crappy equipment because the government folks have these like sort of old style black and white filmed things that they use to go through people's memories, right? And it's older, worse equipment. And if he'd started there with the crappy equipment that he can barely afford to keep up, and then maybe for the third act, right, the big, beautiful equipment that he can actually interact with is something that is sort of the prize for getting through the first part of the movie. But the movie doesn't want to do that. It doesn't want to sort of commit to letting these characters in this world be truly grungy or really be all that interesting beyond just sort of like, here's what we need to get from plot point to plot point. And I totally agree with your assessment that this movie feels chopped up and just doesn't flow very well. I would say even more than that, it's not just that it doesn't flow very well and the bits don't get a chance to breathe. It feels like the bits themselves were not developed enough. This movie feels like a series of bullet points rather than an actual script that kind of flows from sequence to sequence. I don't think most of the scenes work all that well on their own, even if the overall narrative is actually basically coherent in a way that some of the later seasons of Westworld, for example, are not.
The one place where it's a movie that looks like it was a $60 million movie instead of a $150 million movie. And one way you really see this is in the crowd shots. The crowd shots always have like 15 or 20 people at the most, instead of like 50 or 60 people. You know, there's a riot near the end where I'm just like, well, there really aren't that many people here at this riot. Doesn't really feel that that dangerous. Alyssa, what did you make of this?
I thought both that this movie makes sort of a fundamental mistake in what's interesting about its setup, right? This is a movie where climate change has clearly dramatically changed the contours of major cities. And instead of that being the most interesting thing about the world building that like actually drives the storytelling in a deep way, they invent this crazy techno hokum about, you know, memory that is this excuse for a noir plot. And every minute when I was watching this, I was thinking about how much better Kim Stanley Robinson's New York 2041 is. And that is a novel that has a, you know, a noir style mystery. It has a major disaster in the middle of it, but it is a movie that's fundamentally driven by the ways in which New York would redesign itself as a city and people would redesign the way that they lived there if it became a new Venice. And it includes a subplot about property values. But it's one that actually makes sense, right? The part of what's bizarre about this is you have this sort of throwaway line about how the baddie bought up dry land for pennies on the dollar during resource wars. That is just a thing that misunderstands basic economics, right? If the world was in the process of being flooded and high ground became immensely valuable, there is no point at which it would be available at fire sale prices. It's just a completely illogical contradiction, and it shows how little thought goes into the world building of this on some level. They want to show you some cool shots of, you know, neo-Amsterdam-style dikes and levees, and they want to have people splashing through the streets, and they want to throw an Asian-style floating market in there, but they don't have any particular thoughts about how the world would work or why it's different or how things would change culturally other than this fancy invention.
There are those super expensive trains everywhere that are like running, like sloshing through the water, which is not how
running
trains
perfectly.
Work.
Yeah.
And they're fine, right? They're pretty and they're sort of sleek and you're like,
well, and like
what government that can't afford like even like basic interrogation dream technology can somehow or another afford to fund these ridiculous trains that work
nobody's riding on them
in the water and no one is riding on them.
And but I mean, at an even smaller level than that, no one's changed what they wear, even though they're walking through ankle deep water all the time. No one's bothered to build slightly raised sidewalks. You know, just it is sort of all an excuse to do techno babble and no world building at all. And second, this movie is an example of how hard it is to write a good noir script, and really to a certain extent, how hard it is to write a good script in any genre where the stylistic conventions are so well known that everything sounds like a cliche. Because a lot of the writing in this movie is terrible. There's a moment early on when Emily tells Nick that he's late to work, and he sort of jokes back at her, late is a construct of linear time. We don't deal in that. And that's a legitimately sort of funny line that, you know, gives you a sense of what they do. But, I mean, come on. If there are ghosts to be found, it's us who haunt the dark. Memory is the boat that sails against the current, and I'm the oarsman. Like, I just,
I don't mind all this because it does, a trickle
became a flood this time. Maybe this time it would wash the world clean. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't mind this.
No. See, I don't mind this because it is just, it's a hard-boiled voiceover, right? Like, that's what they're doing. They're doing like a kind of mimicry of that, but in this world.
Even if you like that, is this a movie that requires, I mean, every time we are shown something in one of these flashbacks, in the most literal, like, here, we're going to do a scene that's literally exposition. Why does it require Nick to then say, oh my God, this is what I've just seen and how it relates to the plot?
Yeah.
Every single time. I mean, this is an awful script.
Yeah, the movie does not trust the viewers.
No, not at all.
This is a noir written for like 12-year-olds.
It's a noir written for 12-year-olds, both in the sort of construction of the mystery and in the concept, but also just, you know, it's really clunky. It doesn't have the verbal style that the best noirs have, right? I mean, watching a Sam Spade movie is fun because it's fun to listen to Sam Spade. This is just sort of dour and heavy on the metaphor and obvious all of the time. And it has none of the fun or, you know, if you read a Raymond Chandler short story, part of what's fun about it is that the sentences are short and punchy, but they're not blank, right? There's generally something sort of evocative. He has a way with a sharp image. And this script just lacks anything distinctive feeling, right? I mean, you know, noir is stylistic, but it feels grounded to a certain extent. And no human being who's not unbearably, insufferably pretentious walks around commenting on the world in a metaphor that way. It just,
yeah.
I don't know. I think a good noir script is like a beautiful woman. It's pretty in ways you can't put into words.
No. I mean, sorry, Peter. a wonderful noir script is like a beautiful woman. Let me do this correctly. A great noir script is like a woman as beautiful as it is deadly, right? I mean, come on.
Can we talk a little bit about the metaphor and the kind of world building here just for a minute? Because it feels tacked on. The class warfare element feels totally tacked on, and inessential in a way that is like kind of weird and striking. Like they at the last minute were like, ah, crap, we need to get social unrest into this. How can we do this?
I mean, this just strikes me as being this movie wanted to be Chinatown in the future, and Chinatown is about water delivery and dams, yep, and right, and who owns what in a like stratified world of power and money in Los Angeles. And they were like, what if we updated that? And in some ways that's not a terrible idea, an updated Chinatown in a, you know, post in a global warming destroyed Miami
where there's like too much water instead of, sure, not enough,
like,
right?
It's not the dumbest idea I've ever heard for a movie, but then why do you need the memory machine? Make the movie about the world, right? And what's interesting about Chinatown is it's not a movie about a technology, right? There's no memory machine inside that movie. That movie is about the place, about the money, about the land itself, and about the people, right? And yes, there's some weird identity stuff that happens in Chinatown, spoilers. But you don't need, you don't, in some sense, you almost don't need the memory machine to make an interesting movie out of this concept. Now, maybe you could also make an interesting detective story out of just the memory machine, but I don't think you need then the rest of the global warming destroyed world.
Yeah.
Right. Like, yeah, there's actually two concepts here that don't really have anything to do with each other, and they've just sort of been mashed up, and neither of them has been developed well enough to make a movie out of them.
This is a movie that feels like it started with an image in somebody's head, and that image was a detective talks to somebody who is unraveling the secret of the story in a memory to him when he is not the other person in the memory. That is how this, as I was watching it and as that scene was playing out, I was like, this is kind of a striking image. I don't think it really works in the context of everything else that is happening here, but this is clearly like where this movie started. And they kind of worked, and it felt, at least that's what it felt like to me. And then they worked everything back from that.
I mean, it really seemed like they watched Minority Report and watched the bit at the beginning where Tom Cruise watches the video memories of his son, right? And gets lost in that. And we're like, what if you took that? And that was a technology that could be used for, oh, wait, maybe it would start with interrogations and then private detectives would get a hold of a really fancy machine, even though they don't have any money. And anyway, I'll stop harping about this. But like, it struck me very much as like, well, we're the Nolans, we're Mr. and Mrs. Nolan, I guess Mr. Nolan and Miss Joy here.
We should not undersell Lisa Joy as, yes, the writer director on this. It is not a Christopher Nolan Jonathan Nolan production, even if he was an EP
on this. However, like this, the three of them all share a similar set of obsessions. It's pretty clear. And you start with Minority Report, and then you say, well, what's another great noir? It's Chinatown. And how can we kind of combine those two things? And I think they ended up just sort of holding both of them next to each other without actually successfully integrating them.
Also, to be fair, they must have read a lot of The Great Gatsby and gotten really obsessed with the final lines and metaphors, because, like, we're all being born ceaselessly into the past, guys.
Can I complain briefly about the ending of this movie? Which think is a my so spoilers, actual spoilers from here. I have a real issue with the way they treat Rebecca Ferguson's May in this. I feel like it's a total cop out to have her be the kind of hooker with a heart of gold at the end who saves the little kid and, you know, go and explains the whole thing to Nick so he can, you know, figure everything out and stuff. They should have just had her be villainous, just lean into it. And then the real tragedy of him living in this half imagined world at the end would be him actually cutting the sad story short in the middle. So all he remembers is his happy times with this crazy villainous person. I watched it. And at the end, I was very annoyed. I was like, you cannot set this person up to be the villain and us have us pity Nick and then, like, give it all to him anyway. You just can't do that.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Am I just doing a complaint saying I want a different movie than the one we got? It's the worst form, the lowest form of criticism.
I don't think so. I think you're saying that the movie, in trying to be what it wanted to be, failed to do so by making bad choices.
Yes. All right.
And I would agree with that assessment.
What do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Reminiscence? Peter?
Thumbs down.
Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
I'm still going to give it a thumbs up. I still kind of liked
what?
It, honestly.
Sonny.
I still, even with all of my complaints about it, even with my complaints about the end and everything else, I still like this movie.
This
I'm not going to lie.
2 weeks in a row where Alyssa and I were like, no. And you're like, I don't know. I'm not sure.
I liked it. I don't know. Maybe it was just seeing it in IMAX. I went to go see it in IMAX. I got the real experience. And you guys, I assume, did not do that.
That is correct.
Fools.
I watched this.
You fools.
At home on an OLED.
I actually kind of want to watch it on my OLED just to see how inky black the blacks are. All right. Okay. So that is it for today's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode on kids' movies and taking kids to theaters and going to the movies as kids ourselves. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we'll die. Now, if you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. Lots of people do that. They love to complain to me. It's great. But I will convince them and you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.